Talk given Friday, 23rd January 1976.
Each and every single person, creature, or object in the universe is a receptive center for all the energies that play through the universe. Insofar as the object or creature or person is in tune within himself, within itself, there is no obstruction offered by that person or creature or object to the free play of these universal creative energies. Try and feel this. Avoid making any particular mental pictures. The whole universal process is a wonderful play, a play which spells the emergence, the maintenance, the transformation, and the fruition of cosmos out of primordial chaos. Chaos, therefore, not in the sense of disorder or disturbance, but of the primordial state of poised, vibrant being, which is not in action. In fact, in terms of universal fact, although we human beings in the world would be inclined to say that this is sheer inaction. Now, let us sense ourselves as such centers. And this is the fact about ourselves, of which throughout the ages most people are ignorant. And we have to be a center which offers no obstruction to the free play of these universal energies. Now, as far as we, members of the human species, are concerned, one of our outstanding characteristics is that we do offer continuous obstruction to this play. In the orchestra of the universe, we are the one instrument out of tune. Not only out of tune, but on this ill-tempered instrument, we play all sorts of wrong notes and contribute to a state of disharmony from which we ourselves are the first to suffer. And perhaps what is somewhat more sad, we spread suffering and the ill state into the environment. Now, what shall we understand by the term offering no obstruction? Consider carefully, what is it that offers the obstruction? What is it within us which offers the obstruction? Is it not at root our ignorance of the purpose of our existence, or shall I say one of the important purposes of our existence, namely to be perfect receptive centers which are in tune with the universe? We are ignorant of that fact. And secondly, all our desires coupled with our misperceptions, born of both our ignorance and our ununderstood desires and drives and so forth. Ill understood, ill expressed, because unlike other animal species, our brains are developed out of all proportion. And this brain, which really should serve as the instrument of pure intelligence, of clear perception, which would enable us to be perfectly receptive centers and perfectly responsive centers too. This brain has so outrun every other aspect of us that it has become the slave of desire and functions at the mercy of our ignorance. It is essential, if we desire, if we care for the religious life, care for our true human fulfillment, to be well aware of these obstructions within us. Because of these obstructions, what happens all through our waking state every day and in our dream state when we are asleep? We are conscious of a whole host of desires, confusions, conflicts, anxieties, emotions, and so on, in a tremendous turmoil inside us. All human beings, with very rare exceptions, fight against themselves through the waking day and against their environment in order to fulfill their own desire. in order to escape the anxiety produced by their own fear, their own concern about their job or the business in hand or whatever it is. Consider the matter at a cultural level. How many years of one's life a concert artist loses just those 15 minutes or so before he gives his recital? Anxiety, terrible anxiety, unable to be in harmony. Now, if we do not really wake up to the fact of the ill state, the perturbed state, characterized by the pleasure drive, the lust for power, possessions, this, that, and the other, the violence in our nature, the reactivity, the fears, the ambitions, and all the rest of it. If we do not really see into that and acknowledge the fact as it is, we shall, of course, everlastingly obstruct the free, harmonious play of divine energy, the universal forces which play through the world are just expressions of what in religious terms we call divine energy. We can drop the adjective if you like. It is just energy. The entire universal process is a creative action in eternity, transcending the limitations of space and time. That is why that creative action, if unobstructed by us, produces cosmos in space and time, and not a chaos which is a disturbance in space and time. This creative action in eternity. Now, as far as we are concerned, you see the implication of this. Our waking life and our dream life shows this continuous disturbance. It's only in profound slumber, the really deep, dreamless slumber, that we are in the harmless state. And we are in tune, complete harmony with our environment. In dreamless slumber, the really deep, dreamless slumber, there are no desires. There is no thought process. The brain is active just because it is alive. There is no thought process. And in association with that term, thought process, we can see at once that it implies there is no fear, violence, hate, petty little whims, passions, and all the rest of it which constitutes our whole psycho-mental life in the waking state. It is utterly empty of it all. The mind is completely still, completely calm. It's still not in the sense of being stagnant, but in the sense of being vibrantly poised, dynamically poised, intensely active as the perfect receptor and the perfect responder to the play of the energies of the universe. It is in fact an empty mind, not in the vacuous, blank sense of the word, but in the true and the profound and the transcendental sense of the word. The mind is now utterly transparent. But this which happens in deep dreamless slumber only recharges the organism with life energy. That's why we wake up feeling fine, as we call it. We cannot translate, express, work out in terms of form and shape and of action in the waking state in the physical world all that has happened in terms of the free entry and the free exit of the universal energies in our dreamless slumber state. Now consider the fact that the state of dreamless slumber in which we are utterly harmless, utterly in tune, but only unconsciously with the universal process, is the state which, if realized in our waking condition, is the state of the divine communion, the Unio Mystica, the state of the perfected human, which means at last we are truly human. And if in the waking state the mind is empty of all the ill that besets it ordinarily, and all the fantasies and illusions and delusions which clutter up the mind, if we are like that in the waking state, now at last we are indeed the sons and daughters of man, man in the image of God. This is the meaning of that verse in the very first chapter in Genesis. And Elohim said, let us make man in our own image. It's a pity that the words are simply our own image, our own living image would be more expressive and true to the reality. This state of communion is the climactic point, the full fruition of meditation, of yoga. It is to this end that yoga is directed. But we are not sufficiently awake to this fact. Consider how and why thousands of people take to yoga, for instance, or take to any specifically developed religious discipline. Consider very carefully, why do I take to religion, why do I take to yoga, why do I take to the contemplative discipline of either the Catholic or the Buddhist or the Hindu orders, etc. Why do I do this, that and the other? What drives me to it? in most cases, fundamentally, my reaction against my own frustrations and misery in my lifetime, and in the, because my egoism has been thwarted. My ambitions and my self-esteem and all the rest of it. I am terribly self-oriented, self-concerned, utterly ignorant of the fact that this, which is the self here on this planet for just 60 or 70 or 100 years maybe, is only one tiny integral part and parcel of a mighty universe. But my brain has so outstripped the other aspects of my sensitivities, and it has become so absorbed with the self, the separate self misconception, that I never understand how I should approach any activity in life, any discipline whatsoever in life. It is not the self which has to be destroyed or set aside. This very self is the one and only thing, as far as I, the self-conscious individual, am concerned, through which the true, total meaning of self has to find expression. I am absolute part of the cosmos. I cannot deny nature's fact. I cannot deny the fact of the universal creative power which functions eternally. I have to wake up to that, not as a mere thought, because if I were so stupid as to grasp at it as a mere thought, I shall indulge myself in intellectual delight, and I shall expand my egoistic self-conception to the dimensions of the whole cosmos. Fortunately, unlike the frog in the fable, I don't burst physically with that sort of thought process. But consider the misery of my activities, trying to expand this ego to become more egoistic. The ego is a fact. Egoism is the devil inside that living fact. Now, since that devil is living part of me, I haven't got to destroy him. I've got to become good friends with him and see how, when he changes his face, he turns from dark to shining transcendent light, irradiating love and wisdom and beauty. This is the task of yoga, of mysticism, of any religious discipline. This, in fact, is the task before you and me as a human being. If we can be so fortunate as to set our sights rightly, then we will not misdirect our efforts. If we do set our sights rightly, the efforts which we expended with the wrong vision will remain the same efforts, because the technique of the discipline remains the same technique, only it is misapplied. That is all. You use explosives to make a tunnel make a passage for transport, for travel, and so on and so on. You can use explosives in the right way, in a beneficial way, for man's daily life, yours and mine. Or we can use explosives, as unhappily we know only too well in our own day and age, we can use explosives in an evil way, degrading mankind altogether. So now, let us look at this business again. All our disciplines are disciplines which concern us as human beings, which we call religious disciplines, are not disciplines belonging to a limited context called religion, but to the total context, which is our 24-hour daily life. Therefore, everything that happens in our daily life is part of the whole religious process. In the true meaning of the word, it relates us back. It keeps us in harmonious relationship with everything that constitutes our daily life, physically, aesthetically, intellectually, and transcendentally. Now, if you look at yoga this way, how different the whole thing becomes. You know how, for instance, the Buddha said, with respect to one simple aspect of the preliminary discipline, touching the question of food. And he said, food is to be taken not for fun, not for pleasure, not for beautification. He said all these things, you see, but food is to be taken in order to keep the organism going healthily in such a way that it will not obstruct the state of continuous communion with totality, with the reality. That doesn't mean that you don't enjoy your food. That doesn't mean that you don't have good food, in the true meaning of the word good, and so on. You do. But you see, because your sights are set upon the fulfillment of the ways of transcendence, you are really in harmony with the living stream and all the various trends where we human beings are concerned of life itself. Now, we started today with a little gentle breathing. And you know how, in the terms of yoga, we talk of pranayama. Which is generally practiced after some proficiency has been gained with the asanas, the postures. Pranayama, usually translated somewhat inadequately, is the control of the breath, of the breathing. The purpose of the postures is so to discipline the body that it will not interfere with the consciousness process throughout the day, generally speaking. And when you have the opportunity and the inclination during your specific meditation periods. Those of you who have practiced meditation by yourselves in the privacy of your own room, and also group meditation in company with others, must be well aware how, particularly in the privacy of one's own room, the body starts making a nuisance of itself. It will start coughing and sneezing and belly rumbling and itching and goodness knows what not, all the time demanding attention, drawing you away from realizing the state of communion with the totality to its limited, egoistic, vain existence. Look at me, like the little child says, which is very charming where the little infant is concerned, and right and proper for the little infant. Because that little infant has got to grow in such a way as first to realize full egohood, the limited within the self egohood, and then it has to grow out into the realization of true individuality in terms of complete and perfect relationship with the total environment. But the body will interfere like that, demand attention, and that interference has its roots in our natural evolutionary process. We are descended from a primordial ancestor who was a primate, as most scientists think. And therefore we have, the primate was an animal, pure and simple. So we have within us the inherited forces and activities which belong to our animal nature. And the animal is a creature, the healthy animal is a creature, and is rightly so, which draws everything to itself for its self-preservation and existence and the preservation of the species. Having done that, it has done its job. It has fulfilled its place in the scheme of things. And in that sense, it is totally in communion with nature. With us, something new has come into being. This possibility of awareness of that which is outside us, as well as our own withinness, and the possibility of something which is transcendent, altogether transcendent, to the within and the without as two duals, the self and the not self. This is something which exclusively characterizes us as compared with all other living creatures. So now, the asanas train the body not to interfere, train the body to be quiet. And in that quietness, there is generated a nervous energy which is tremendous. I mean, you all, those of you who practice yoga, you know from your actual experience what an astonishing nervous energy is liberated. Yoga training will not make you defeat Muhammad Ali in a boxing match. or run up and down Everest 3 times a day, or do anything so fantastic, or create a 2-minute running a mile record. It's not intended for that sort of thing. It's intended to release you bodily into a state where the human body is truly human, free of subhumanity, free of bestiality. Now, why do I use the term bestiality here? Consider briefly, what does the average human being do with his so-called healthy body? He thoroughly enjoys himself, as he says, which means he squanders his energies upon his lusts and his pleasures and the expression of his egoistic feeling of superiority and domination over others, over the environment, over nature, over matter, with his inventions and industry and becoming a tycoon and what other coon, I don't know, a cocoon would be better, and so forth. Isn't that true? Is not that how we who are this marvelous creation, human beings, actually live? Inhumanly, subhumanly, bestially. So this is what a person does with his healthy body. Very rarely you come across a man or a woman so wise who does not misuse the body, who knows what it means to understand first and reverence the body as the temple of the spirit. And the spirit is not my little possession, something locked inside me. Not my little 250,000-pound diamond which I wear on my ring. It is the one universal reality, a mysterious thing, a thing of awe and reverence and wonder and beauty, unimaginable, unimaginable, unthinkable, not to be restricted, not to be limited. That is the spirit. And the body is the temple of the Most High. All the religions have presented this. So the postures deal with that aspect of the thing. And then this other aspect, pranayama. Now look at the position of this which is called pranayama. Call the control of the breath, or breathing techniques and so on, breathing practices. And if you study your Upanishads carefully, you'll find all sorts of very puzzling statements in this connection, but at the same time you will also find some statements, a few here and there, which really give you the key to understand it. Prana means life. And yama means disciplining, controlling in the sense of true discipline. True control is not something forcibly imposed upon that which you control, preventing it from doing what is against your personal petty will. Do you realize that? Now, prana, life, as used in the texts throughout all the religious literature of the world, not only India, life is a universal term. But we, particularly in our day and age, are so conditioned from our young days that we associate the word life with just the life of a body. To us, the biological aspect of life overshadows every other aspect of it. But you know, they put it very simply and cryptically in the Chandogya Upanishad. Brahman, the absolute all, the totality, is prana. Brahman is kham. Brahman is kha. Brahman is the void, kham and kha. Brahman is bliss. Now, the absolute, the supreme, is life, the void, which is the state of bliss. Therefore, bliss is not pleasure here. Bliss is not delight. Bliss is nothing emotional, nothing intellectual. It transcends all this. It represents the state of being exactly what being in itself is fundamentally, indescribably. This is the marvel of these teachings, and it is extremely difficult to penetrate into their inner meanings. So, pranayama. Now, do you begin to get a feel of what is implied in just those two aspects? But notice their position in the Eightfold Scheme. You start with the moralities, yama, the religious observances, they are called niyama, and then you come to asana. Then you talk of pranayama. Then you talk of pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. But life, which is the totality, because all this is integral part and parcel of the totality, from beginning to end, yoga is one whole yoga, not exclusively confined to body or mind or meditation or anything like that as a specific thing. It is the whole thing. Life, up to the asanas, concerns limited manifestation, doesn't it? You and I, as psychophysical organisms, observing the moralities, living them spontaneously and naturally, not forcibly, not repression, nor our mistaken concept of expression, the moralities, the religious observances permeating the whole of daily life and the bodily discipline. Life is concerned with the limited organism. There. And then, from the time you begin pranayama and move onwards through pratyahara and so forth, that same life is concerned with freeing you from limited consciousness of yourself as a particular psychophysical organism, and enables you to be at home with the totality, which you can be at home with and in union with only in terms of mind and consciousness. No one creature, no one object can be in the state of union with totality physically. It's impossible. The limited, finite, particular manifestation, only in terms of mind and consciousness, can be in harmony with the totality. Not as a thought merely. This is the very, very important point. Not as just a feeling, a nice feeling, a feeling of expansion. You can get it just as much in a feeling of contraction till you come to the infinite point. The point is infinite. No length, breadth, depth, immeasurable. You expand, you again get to immeasurability. See the point? Right. So this pranayama, this control, this understanding of life, at the fourth point in the presentation of the teaching of yoga, actually controls, and that is to say, let us not use the word control, harmonizes both ways now. The finite organism with that in us which can not merely aspire to, but actually enter into that state of being at home with the universal in terms of mind and consciousness. And life goes right through all this. Breath is the concretest expression of the life force, the rhythm of breathing. It is the rhythm of breathing which does it, not just the oxygen-nitrogen mixture and all that kind of stuff. That rhythm of breathing means that this bit of oxygen and nitrogen which goes in and the other gases and which goes out of your body, they are alive in activity, and you bodily are alive and in activity. Now if you appreciate and understand this, then you will see how this breath rhythm, and breath is the concretest expression of life, this breath rhythm it's a little bit difficult to put this. The rhythmic aspect of life, the life rhythm, let us use the term life rhythm. The life rhythm suffuses the psychological and the transcendental sides of our being. So pranayama extends right throughout all the eight angas, the eight limbs of yoga. Now this is the great significance of pranayama. If you understand the significance, then you yourself can utilize your own breath rhythm in the right way. You might ask me, well, now what is the right way to utilize my own breath rhythm? Don't you try to utilize your breath rhythm, the life rhythm part of it. Don't you try to control that or direct it. Because it is the universal power, and who can be so unwise or Lucifer-like, aspiring to equality with the Almighty, to lay down to universal life that it shall work this way and that way. Let it work through you. You see, this is where every single man and woman functions as the female. The aspiration and the positive willingness to give yourself to the totality is the aspect where every single man and woman acts as the male. The male serves the female. It's the female who demands throughout the universal process. And it's the male who serves. The male cannot serve as long as he has a will of his own, a mind of his own, as we say. So when this process is extended into the realm of pratyahara, dharana, dhyana and samadhi, you get the total harmony and the perfect expression of pranayama. What happens now? Because we must come back to our original point. We are centers, living centers, receptive centers, and responsive agents. That's what we are. our state, if we realize this, is the state which, whilst we are awake, is the perfect expression of our dreamless slumber state. We are completely asleep whilst we are totally wide awake. Paradox. But the simple truth, you see what I mean? The great mystics of the world, the yogis, you'll find it scattered throughout the Upanishads, this sort of statement, that for the religia, the so-called waking state for mankind is the sleeping state. He's for half, he's fast asleep, he's ignorant, he's stupid, he's incapable. He's just a beast. Not even a good animal. No human being is permitted to be a good animal just purely as an animal. Because we do have this brain and we do have this transcendent aspect working through us, in us and through us. So there we are. They call this so-called waking state, the sleeping state, the dull state, the dead state. But in every one of us is this divine possibility. It's always at work. But remember, it never works compulsively. God never compels. Transcendence never compels. Compulsion is a phenomenon which is restricted to that which is limited, finite and particular, and which is not in perfect relationship with everything around it. Therefore, it tries to compel, or if it is weak, other finite, limited particulars, other human beings, other creatures, try to compel it. That's where compulsion is. But where eternity is concerned, where transcendence is concerned, there is no such thing as compulsion. There is this peculiarity about it. There is an infinitely sweet, irresistibility on the part of transcendence. It just is. Transcendence just is. And transcendence, God, Brahman, use whichever word you like, being the totality, it doesn't have any need or purpose or anything to try and wake you up or this, that, and that. Each one of us is part and parcel of it. Out of that extraordinary totality, each one of us, as a human being, as a creature, as a physical object, is expressed into limited, finite manifestation. It goes through its living process, and it goes out of expression into the supreme, unknowable by the brain state, but which is there, which is a reality. So you see, the waking state for us humans is the state of communion. The state where, in being, as if in perfect dreamless slumber, with the mind utterly empty of all little disturbances which it generates, you are entirely awake to the transcendent reality. I haven't said anything about pratyahara and so on up to samadhi tonight, because after all we are limited in time. We can talk about that again and again and again on future occasions. But I hope that what we have considered together tonight may prove to be a stimulus which could lead to an inner awakening, an awakening in quiet. When you awaken in quiet, in the quiet of the soul, you don't try to grab, to grasp that which you have awakened to. That which is of supreme wonder and beauty, which is the simple truth, the absolute truth of our existence itself, is something not to be grabbed. Grasp it, and it immediately disappears. You know how often I have drawn your attention to that wonderful myth of Eros and Psyche. Psyche's curiosity got the better of her, wanted to see Eros. To see Eros means to see transcendent love. Eros, I know that we have this word erotic and we usually associate Eros with erotic, but this is our mistake in modern times. They taught something quite different in the old days. How, out of her curiosity, wanting to see Eros meant the desire and the urge to make finite, limited, particular, and therefore mortal, that which was infinite and immortal. Don't write to God and ask for an interview personally. You are being interviewed by God every single split second of your existence. It's not just a poetic, mystical fancy, in him we live and move and have our being. Instead of him, you can say in her, you can say in it, you can say in that, we live and move and have our being. It is the fact, the simple fact of the total reality. And when you wake up to it in inner consciousness, so that it becomes quite a natural daily thing, you are the true yogi.